And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Usry, and I'm happy to welcome Alice Randall back to the program today for the second of a two-part interview. Book lovers know Alice for her best-selling novels, The Wind Ungone, Rebel Yell, Black Bottom Saints, among others. But before writing prose, Alice wrote country songs in Nashville, including X's and O's, which went to the top of the charts with Trisha Yearwood, making Alice the first African-American woman to write a number one country hit record. Her new book, My Black Country, A Journey Through Country Music's Black Past, Present, and Future, interweaves her life story and the history of African-American musicians who helped make country music what it is today, despite attempts at sidelining or erasing their contributions. Alice, thank you so much for coming back and talking with us again about My Black Country. It's really a pleasure to have you on the show again.
It's thrilling to be back. As I said, I love every opportunity to get literally or virtually to Memphis.
You mentioned Lil Hardin, Louis Armstrong, and Jimmy Rogers cutting Blue Yodel No. 9 together, but this wasn't at the Ralph Peer Sessions in Bristol, was it? It was out on the West Coast.
Absolutely. In 1930, they recorded in Los Angeles. And I hate to break it to Memphis and Nashville, but I consider Los Angeles to be the capital of Black country.
That's a big statement right there.
Well, there's so many things that I can point to. One is Lil and Louie and Jimmy Rogers cutting Blue Yodel No. 9 there. But if I consider the pioneers of Black country to be D4 Bailey as the papa, Lil Hardin Armstrong as the mama, Ray Charles to be their genius child who drops modern sounds in country and Western music, Charlie Pride to be Dee Ford's side child or love child. Dee Ford will be the first Black member of the Opry. Charlie Pride will be the second. And Herb Jeffries, the bronze buckaroo, discovered by Lil in Detroit, but he will go out to Los Angeles and make in the 30s and 40s these bronze buckaroo Black singing cowboy movies. Those five, Lil, Dee Ford, Ray Charles, Charlie Pride, Herb Jeffries. That's the first family of Black country. And of those, Hardin, Jeffries, Charles, Bill Withers, and Lionel Richie, who are their descendants, they spent more than 210 years living and working in Los Angeles and creating what I call a mappable legacy. And so because of Herb Jeffries making those movies out there, Ray Charles living there, Lil recording there early. And then we got Bill Withers living out there. And Bill Withers, quiet as it's kept, grandson of coal miners, Black coal miners. Bill Withers is country. I think Los Angeles is the capital of Black country.
Now, back in the late 70s, I don't think Brick House would have made a chartable country song, but I think in the last 15 years, it certainly could have.
Of course, you're referring to Lionel Richie, who wrote Lady for Kenny Rogers, who wrote an entire country album called Tuskegee that's very interesting. Lionel has roots to Alabama, and he has genius insight into the creation of country songs. And another thing that's country about white and Black country about Los Angeles is the recording of We Are the World. And We Are the World has so many people who are associated with country and Black country on it, starting with Lionel Richie, including Dolly Parton and others.
Why did you decide to interweave your own memoir and own story with the story of the larger Black country music?
Well, several reasons. One, country has always sustained me and been part of me. As I told you, I came to it from my mama, my auntie, and my grandmother, and it was the good thing I got from my mother. So my story and country music are entwined to me. The second one is my definition of country music is Celtic, English, Irish, Scottish ballad forms, plus African aesthetics, plus evangelical Christianity. So it's white, Black, and spiritual. I say I am embodied country music. I have a Black identity, but when I've done my DNA testing, most of my ancestry, more than 50%, is English, Scottish, and Irish. And then I also have Cameroon and Nigeria. So I am embodied country music, and country music has always sustained me. And I love country music and have written and worked in country music. I will be 65 in May, and I'm in my 41st year as a professional country songwriter. And I told you I wrote my first country song in a Motown cherry tree. I've had 60 years writing country and Western music. And I love that and Western part because it reminds me to tell you about one of my favorite influences on country and on the Black West are Black and Brown cowboy singers and cowboys. That of the original 19th century and 20th century cowboys, we think 20 to 30% of them were Black and Brown. And they have a culture of singing. And this culture of singing has influenced the Western part, the Texas swing part of country music, and the narrative storytelling of country. And so that is yet another influence. And one of the things I'm excited about in my own songs that I've been writing across these 41 years is I celebrate a lot of Black cowboys. The songs on my album, one is Girls Ride Horses, two, another is Get the Hell Out of Dodge, another is Went for a Ride. These are Black cowboy songs reimagined by me in the 20th century and reimagined by the wonderful singers who are singing them, Adia Victoria, Sister Strings, Sania, in the 21st century.
And I remember you mentioned when you're talking about Went for a Ride, you did that with Rodney Foster, and that white listeners don't pick up that in the very first line, the cowboy in the song is Black. And I'll have to cop to that. Yep, you're right.
Well, I'm amazed and pleased that you're acknowledging that some people don't get that that cowboy is Black. And then sometimes in the Justin McBride version, if they do understand he's Black, they don't believe he is an equally good cowboy as Justin McBride. But when Adia sings it, I have discovered that listeners have been convinced. It is one great Black genius tipping their hat to another. And I am so thrilled to hear it. When The Ballad of Sally Ann came out, this is Rhiannon Giddens singing a song I co-wrote with Mark O'Connor and Harry Stinson a long time ago. It's about a man who gets lynched between his wedding and his reception. It was on a fantastic album called The New Nashville Cats, a Grammy-nominated album. Mark O'Connor, who many people have considered to be the world's great fiddle player, Isaac Stern even once said he was the world's best violin player, and John Cowan sang lead on it, and he had been the voice of Newgrass Revival, one of the great Newgrass voices of the 20th century. That was an excellent, a powerful version of the song, but it was at a distance. It was a white gaze on and at a Black body swinging from the trees, a white gaze that can't and doesn't stop the crime. When Rhiannon Giddens sings this song, it's embodied resistance. It is Black love cutting through the destruction to persist in loving. She transforms into a ghost that continues to love even after death. And she continues to love after her husband's death when she's living and sounds a reckoning bell. Sally attends every wedding round here. She's a visual and audio reckoning bell, but she's embodied resistance as sung by Rhiannon and as produced by Ebony Smith, the brilliant woman from Memphis, Tennessee, who produced my album, My Black Country, The Songs of Alice Randall. As produced by Ebony, her genius gesture is she puts horns on the end of that song. And some people say, why are those horns there? Why are the horns there? The horns are there to remind us that lynching continued well into the middle of the 20th century, that Emmett Till was lynched after he was drugged, and that lynching continued not in the old-timey music of the 19th century and the 18th century. It continued into the 20th century through the era of jazz, through the era of horns, almost up to the advent of rock and roll. That's brilliant Memphis-born Ebony, putting in a layer of meaning. on top of the layer of meaning that Rhiannon carved into it, on top of the layers of meaning Harry Stinson, Mark O'Connor, and I worked hard to get into that song. And I am honored and thrilled, but also something I feel good about the fact that Harry and Mark O'Connor have just both reached out to me to celebrate this new version of the song. And Harry was so articulate and so complete, so full in his praise of how the song, Rhiannon's version, takes it up a whole nother level, how this is the song more fully realized. In fact, in a way that he had not known he wished to see it fully realized, but now was thrilled to see it fully realized. And Mark O'Connor also claiming participation in it and also acclaiming Florence Joplin. He wanted to tell me about her, that he had continued to learn and grow. And it's so thrilling to me that these two people who helped me create the song in the first place have sat with me as audience for the song in this new place and have sat back to let the Black women be foreground and are willing to be our audience. And there's some grace in that. And there's some full circle. I'll just say there are a couple of co-writers I haven't heard from. And I'm thrilled that some of my co-writers, Mark Sanders in particular, celebrating this album with such full-hearted support. And Harry Stinson, Mark O'Connor, celebrating it with full-hearted support.
One of your efforts nowadays is to preserve and celebrate and uncover the history of Black country music. And one of the first instances of erasure was a man you've mentioned many times, D. Ford Bailey, who you write was the most frequent guest at the Grand Ole Opry its first year. And then what happened?
D. Ford Bailey's story is one of the most tragic stories in Black country music, particularly the way it is typically told. D. Ford will be the Opry's first superstar, not first Black star, the Opry's first superstar. He will support the early careers of Opry stalwarts such as Roy Acuff. However, he will be forced off the Opry around the time of the advent of television in the early 40s. He'll be forced off the Opry. And they will tell the story that after he left, that he turned into a quote-unquote shoeshine boy and sort of disappeared and vanished. And they tell the story that this all happened to him because he was too lazy to write new songs. None of this is true. D. Ford Bailey continued to make music in the Black community until the week and day he died. And not only did he continue to make music, he continued to inspire his own son and grandchildren, who were also significant musicians. But more intimately and powerfully to me, D. Ford Bailey, in the late 60s and early in the 70s, would join forces with Avon Inyanza Williams. Avon Inyanza Williams would become known as Senator Avon Williams when he became elected as the first Black state senator in Tennessee history. Part of how he got there was D. Ford Bailey writing and recording a jingle for him that went out on the radio and got him votes. D. Ford Bailey helped put into office the first Black state senator in Tennessee history, and he sustained him as he was keeping him in office. The very last time Senator Williams, my daughter's grandfather, that's the intimate connection, the very last time Senator Williams was running for office, he was experiencing a significant health challenge. He was battling ALS. He could only move in a wheelchair, electric wheelchair. He could not speak so that he was heard by other people. He had to slowly type using only two or three fingers. He had to work with translators who struggled to understand what he was saying. And he was competing for his office with somebody, a much younger lawyer, who seemed very vigorous and seemed to be playing to our family's eyes and ears the ableist card. But Big Avon persisted. He did not win by a large margin, but he won. And right around that time, I said to him, "How does it feel to have your first political jingle?" And when breath was so hard to come by for him, when he could barely lift a finger, he lifted an entire fist. He used all of his energy and focus to lift his fist and say, "D. Ford Bailey wrote my first jingle." I'm still shocked. It brings me to tears to remember it. The effort he made to claim D. Ford's name and tell that history. It was worth writing this whole book to give D. Ford publicly his true ending. Because it wasn't just that he wrote that jingle. It was that I could tell that Avon, Big Avon, as we called him, my daughter's grandfather, was inspired to make that last fight in the wheelchair, hardly able to talk, by the reality of D. Ford's lived experience of having worked and fought his way through country music after having had polio when he was very young and being someone that other people described as crippled. But this is how Big Avon felt it back then. D. Ford was in no way crippled. He was just differently, superiorly abled. And that is who and what D. Ford inspired Big Avon to be. And differently and superiorly abled. And he did it from across the grave, because D. Ford was dead by the time I arrived in Nashville. He died a year before I got here and was dead by the time Big Avon was fighting for his political life in the 80s. But that is the true end of D. Ford Bailey's story. He put Avon Williams in office the first time he was part of that, and he helped keep him in office and reminded him of why he should feel dignified in his wheelchair.
And the nerve of Roy Acuff to say he wasn't writing new material when I had to listen to Great Speckled Bird 3,000 times.
All of those people, Roy Acuff in particular, when they were at the 25th anniversary of the CMA, where I was there in Washington, D.C. in 1983, 2 days before I got in the car to drive to Nashville. And they talked about country music being a big family. And they called Jimmy Rogers' name. They even call the name of the comedian Will Rogers. But no one calls D. Ford's name. And a whole lot of those people had stood on the Opry stage with him. And even more of them had sung on the radio with him. Herb Jeffries was still alive. No one called his name. But D. Ford was a founder of the Opry Feast, and his name should have been called loud.
Now, I know you couldn't mention every person who ever cut country records who's African-American, but I was wondering, not addressing country soul and how it kind of crossed over with country music and, you know, figures like Joe Simon and Dobie Gray.
I want to call another name from Memphis first. Like, I can't even, that I can't mention everybody, but who am I want to talk to you about with you next? You can't call Dobie Gray before you call Al Green and Bell Album, one of the great country albums of all time. I love Bell. I love Aaron Neville's Grand Tour. The Pointer Sisters, so important to me. But as I said, of people that we don't think of as country, another one that I love, it's a song about Memphis. That's how I got to Memphis, sung by the great Solomon Burke. I think that song sounds pretty country to me. And I think that was originally Tom T. Hall, right, that wrote that. I love Solomon Burke when he starts singing country to me. And who also loved Solomon Burke was Van Morrison. And I hear in Van Morrison, he did his old country album. I think Van Morrison learned a lot of his country from Solomon Burke.
I have a weird music fixation, Christmas music. And of course, Solomon Burke's Presents for Christmas is way there at the top for me.
Love that too. I love Christmas songs. Oh, we also can't get out of here. I'll be terribly remiss if we don't call Tina Turner's name. Nutbush City Limits is a very important country song. And Tina Turns the Country On is very interesting. And we also need to go back just a teeny bit. I haven't talked about him this whole time launching this book so far. Nat King Cole, since you just mentioned Christmas music. I'm not saying Chestnuts is a country song, because I don't think it is. But he actually has a beautiful version of Twilight on the Trail. And Nat King Cole sings a lot of country. And I think, strangely enough, in some odd way, Straighten Up and Fly Right is a country song. But he certainly did an entire album of country songs. And my favorite is probably Twilight on the Trail.
And while the beginnings of country music was really influenced by Piedmont blues music, later on, the Western music scene, especially Western swing, owes a debt to jazz music and the traveling orchestras.
Absolutely. And I talk about that in my book. But it also owes a debt to Western gospel music. The Azusa Street Revival in Los Angeles, there's a brilliant pianist called Arizona Drains. And that was coming in from the Kojic Church of God in Christ tradition. Because you have to remember that a lot of early Black gospel was a cappella, and a lot of Black churches did not believe that you should put instruments with their church music. And also, a lot of them just couldn't afford it. So between this necessity and theology, we get the Fisk Jubilee Singers, these all this music that has voices without instrumentation. But this Church of God in Christ, in this particular church in Los Angeles, say, no, we need the cymbals. They're pulling out all the Bible verses that talk about instruments. And then the way Arizona Drains pounds rhythmically, works the piano, reminds me a lot of Jerry Lee Lewis, reminds me a lot of Ray Charles, and it sure reminds me a lot of Lil Hardin Armstrong, who we can put on the same session with Arizona Drains before she plays on that Jimmy Rogers session in LA again. So Arizona Drains is another part of making Los Angeles the capital of Black country, because that's where that California gospel is coming in.
Also, Kojic is headquartered where? Memphis, Tennessee.
You know, I did not know that.
The world headquarters are here.
Aha. Uh-huh. Didn't know that.
How does a young Black woman endeavor to enter into a genre of music that has put up such high barriers for Black talent?
Well, it's a lot of audacity. You got to be audacious. Black women, we are find a way or make a way people. I wanted to make a way for myself into this world. I thought of it as political music. I thought of it as preaching to the unconverted, that I wanted to address segments of the world that did not see me as fully human and people that look like me as having full potential. I wanted to change that from the inside through the art. And that's what I've done, I hope. A little bit. Let people realize with a song like Who's Minding the Garden that Black people care about the environment and that echo grief is real before we even had that phrase. Let people know that there were those Black cowboys. Let people know that some of that homeless people are freezing on the streets. Now, that was an early song that I wrote. I remember writing in 87. It was recorded, I think, in 88. I wrote in 87. When I was living in New York with my first husband and my baby daughter, we were living in Chelsea, and I was beginning to see for the first time unhoused people freezing in the cold. But the unhoused person I was worried about the day I moved towards really writing that song was a brown woman who'd come up from the South. But when people hear Mo Bandy singing, they're imagining a white man. And, you know, I love that song, I Sang Dixie as He Died. People get when Dwight sings that, he's talking about a white person coming from where he came from. But they lose when I was thinking about many mansions, that I'm thinking about there are brown and Black women who come from the South and get lost and tangled in the streets of New York and lose their life where I've seen life still by winter's bitter chill. I love that the great Alison Russell rewrote the lyric. Mark Sanders, Carol Ann Etheridge, and I wrote on that. And she turned it to, "In my mother's house are many mansions," which I love. And that puts the song in conversation with another song of mine, Big Dream, which has the lines in it, "Makes me think maybe God's a woman too. Makes me think maybe God's a woman too." So Alison hits when we say, "In my mother's house are many mansions," rewriting us and rewriting the King James Bible, we're getting a bigger, broader view of God. And that's the thing I told you, that country is Celtic narrative strategies, ballot forms, plus African influences, plus evangelical Christianity. Many of my songs have directly addressed that evangelical Christianity. They challenge the hypocrisy in it, but they ratify the notion of God in the universe. There's who's minding the garden. That's a question about Eden and about what is our responsibility to the physical world. God's a woman too. In my father's house are many mansions. I've heard about the eye of the needle. Reckless Night, my first recorded song, was about a young unwed mother, a boy and a girl who fall in love, singing in the choir, make love in the green grass. But when the baby comes, the church keeps the boy inside its shelter. And the girl is out in the churchyard with the rain and God. I love the rain and God in that song, because the rain is that African sacred nature. And God is that Judeo-Christian God we got in this world. But she's out there with God and nature. And I'm worried about that boy singing in the choir, because there's a line in there, "And cleanse him of a sin he'll always hide." In that church he's going to, you don't get cleansed of sin, you hide.
Around that same time, there was a jazz composition called Many Mansions by Sonny Chirac. And that just puts me a mind of the time. I was listening to so many great country guitar pickers like Don Rich and Pete Anderson. And perhaps the father of the country guitar style was a man by the name of Esli Riddle.
Absolutely. Esli Riddle, when typically people are telling the story of the founding of country, they often say that Jimmy Rogers was the papa and Mother Maybelle was the mama. But Esli Riddle is a person who was living in the same larger community that the Carter family were living in. He was a person who had had one accident in which he lost a leg, we think, and then another accident, which may have been a failed suicide attempt, in which he lost two fingers. And in the absence of these two fingers, he started playing the guitar in a very specific and unexpected way. The way he played the guitar as we know it looks a lot like Carter family scratch. Not exactly the same thing, but we know the Carter family early in the career, at the beginning, will receive songs from Esli Riddle. And we know that they receive sounds from Esli Riddle. And they may have received guitar techniques from Esli Riddle. The Carters and Esli Riddle would perform together over the years. And that's very problematic and complicated because they tell a lot of stories about Esli Riddle. I'm not sure all of them are true. They say that he was called Esli Riddle because the Carter family children couldn't pronounce his real name, which was Leslie. When I found him in the census, and the census can get things wrong, but the U.S. Census, I found him as a child as Esli Riddle in the census repeatedly. There are sometimes it says Leslie or Wesley, but from the beginning, he was called Esli in the census. So what we know is that we know for sure the Carters acknowledged that they got songs from Esli Riddle, that they learned some guitar techniques and chords from Esli Riddle. How much more did he really contribute? And the hard part is we can't know. We can't know because if Esli Riddle had said he invented Carter family scratch, the Carters would never have let him back on that stage with them again. If Esli Riddle had said that he invented Carter family scratch, people would have thought he was crazy. If Esli Riddle had claimed this, he wouldn't have made the little bit of money he did make. What I wish, and I talk about this in My Black Country, is that someone had gone and interviewed Esli Riddle's older brother after Esli was dead, when he didn't need anything else. from the Carters or from the establishment that supported them? What story would he have told? And I think it's very interesting that of all the scholars out there, some of whom wrote extensively about Esley Riddle while the brother was still alive, that none of them interviewed him, because that man lived until relatively recently. He was available for a significant amount of time, and he was actually a minister. He was a little bit better educated. He had a lot different power, and he didn't need the music establishment. He might have told a very different story. But we do know, and I'm glad we're getting a fuller story, about Esley Riddle was a profound influence on the Carters. We have to thank Ken Burns and his team for bringing the national attention to that, that it has had. I think I take it the story a little bit further, but Ken Burns did a really good job of including Esley Riddle in the Carter family story.
And you yourself felt the power of leverage being put on you. Can you tell us about the Blonde Shark?
Oh, I won't tell that much about it, but at the height of my country music career, I walked away from it. I walked away from it because I like to say, in business, you don't get what's fair, you get what you negotiate. When I was young, I didn't know the difference between people who are being nice to me in my career and actual friends. So I said, I listened to some things I shouldn't have listened to, and I signed a contract I didn't read or get my lawyer to check because I've been swimming in somebody's swimming pool, or my child had been too, and I just couldn't imagine anybody that let me swim in their swimming pool would do me any which way but lose. There's sharks in the music business. What's wild about that is they were sharky to everybody back in those days. I don't even think I was singled out for race and gender in that. I was singled out for being a fool who did not read a contract or send it on to my lawyers because I trusted somebody who was nice to me.
So it begins the book and ends the book. Can you tell us about the project for the Alice Randall Black Country Songbook?
You know, the book I wrote right before My Black Country is my last novel, Black Bottom Saints, about the music community where I was born, Black Bottom, Detroit. And when I was about to go out on book tour with that, people kept on asking me for a Spotify playlist, both of the soundscape of my Black Detroit from that period and of my own songs, because they were interested in how I had become a songwriter. But when I listened to those old songs, they were breaking my heart, particularly because my Black characters were so erased from them, particularly because I had always hoped sometime in this 40 years, I was going on 40 years then, a Black female artist would appear, country artist, and record some of these songs. And I get to hear them as I had imagined them, if not the first time, the next time. And it looked like that wasn't going to happen. And I started writing My Black Country, and I got way far into it. And the desire to have those songs recovered got more and more intense. And out on book tour with Black Bottom Saints, I got to meet Allison Russell. And she had some ideas about this. And my daughter was doing a ballet with Rihanna and Giddens. And she had some ideas about this. And I was becoming more and more increasingly aware of the work of Reese Palmer, because I was teaching her in a course I initiated in 2015 called Black Country. And between Allison and Rhiannon and Reese and my own daughter, Caroline Randall Williams, before I knew it, talking to Caroline, she said, you need to reach out to Fiona Prine, Oh Boy Records. You need to do an album to go with your book. You need to get your songs re-recorded. And initially, I was thinking about it being one artist. And it was Allison Russell who told me it needs to be a group of artists, a community collaborating. Also, I had named Ebony Smith emphatically and said, this is a person that should produce this album. And it was a very great idea. And Caroline also brought Valerie June. They knew each other from the Folk Alliance. I had known her from sharing a stage with her and Alison Moore and Rhiannon at an event years back at the War Memorial, which is a place Dee Fort sang on the Opry, War Memorial Auditorium in Nashville. But it was just so extraordinary to find in the 21st century these amazing group of Black women riding to the rescue of my legacy. Sonny War, Allison Russell, Rhiannon Giddens, Reese Palmer, Miko Marx, Adia Victoria, Sania, Valerie June, Sister Strings, my own daughter, Caroline, Layla McCalla, just all this Black woman genius coming to lift me up and add a transformative layer of creation onto the audacious early layers of creation. It was more than hard won, happy. It was Sankofa, looking back to move forward. And it was Juneteenth, good news at last. It is this album for me, an extraordinary Juneteenth moment. And I hope this Juneteenth, there'll be people all over the country listening to this album, listening to Cowboy Carter, and recognizing the good news at last that this music form that so many people claim as a quintessential American music form, I know some people claim that for jazz, but so many people claim that for country, and this year, a whole lot more people are going to understand the Black roots of country. And a whole lot more people are going to honor the African-American greats who are the founders of the Best of Country Feast. Dee Fort Bailey, Lil Hardin Armstrong, Ray Charles, Herb Jeffries, Charlie Pride, and now Beyoncé. I think of her metaphorically as the genius child of the genius child. If Ray Charles is the genius child of Dee Ford and Lil, in my metaphor, Beyoncé is the genius child of Ray Charles, the daughter who eclipses the father's genius. My favorite song on the album, her album, is 16 Carriages, or I also love the one about sheltering a child protector. And I feel like a protector writing this memoir of the Black country legacy of what of the people I consider to be the first family of Black country. And it's thrilling to me to be on a radio show with you because Dee Ford's country experience was born on the radio. It's deeply moving to me to be on the radio and carry him in to the honors he deserves.
Alice Randall, thank you so much for spending time with us this week and last week. It has been a pleasure.
It has been an absolute pleasure to be with you, Stephen. This is one of the great book shows of America, and may you long persist.
And I will keep blushing. Alice Randall is the author of My Black Country, A Journey Through Country Music's Black Past, Present, and Future, which is published by Atria Black Privilege Publishing. Also, the CD and vinyl of My Black Country, The Songs of Alice Randall, is available from Oh Boy Records. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is produced in the studios of FM 89.3 WYPL Memphis, a service of the Memphis Public Library, a division of the City of Memphis. Book Talk is copyrighted by the Memphis Public Library, all rights reserved.